Hi everyone. I think we'll make a start now. I'm sure there'll be plenty of people coming in later. Thanks for coming to today's session. That's the APS 330 Home Lending Data Applications and Insights. Just a quick sort of bio for our presenter. Tim Gorst is an actuary working within the NAB. He has around 15 years of financial services experience working across both banking and the wealth business. And he'll take us through his presentation for about 20 to 30 minutes, and then we'll open it up for discussions after that. Thank you. Tim?
Good morning. Thanks, everybody, for coming along and hearing some of the thoughts from the paper. Look, this is a banking paper, and I do recognise some banking actuaries here, so thanks, guys, for coming along. And certainly I'm not planning on speaking for more than 20, 25 minutes, and then we'll have some discussion and go out and enjoy a coffee if we finish a bit early. The paper that I've written, I just want to thank Phil for your peer review. The APS 330 reports that have come out from the big banks, I think we need to just pause and appreciate how much money has been spent by the big banks on implementing Basel II. These reports are just but one of the outputs from that whole process. I think we also just need to reflect they're a completely new thing for the industry. It's really only been around for a couple of points, and certainly the work that I've done here, there are insights that I'm going to share with you. But a lot of it is just an approach to doing a diagnostic on the Australian New Zealand home lending system. And one of the issues with that approach is it's only really using three periods of data points. So this is very much a work in progress, and I'll be updating this as sort of more data comes to hand. But the thoughts that I'm going to share with you is a little bit about that approach, then jumping into some of the insights and finishing with a thought around how we can monitor credit risk system-wide a little more collaboratively within Australia and New Zealand. So the home lending system is a very big system. And indeed, credit is $2.2 trillion across both Australia and New Zealand. The home lending system, which is the focus of this paper, a couple of reasons why I focused on home lending. It is very topical. Not a day goes by that you don't read something in the press about the home lending system. And we're all reminded, and I think it's quite well known now, that the genesis of the US global, which turned into the global financial crisis, was a collapse in the US housing market, which then translated into quite bad credit problems over in the US. And so I think where the global financial sort of system has become quite aware that it's within the housing system that lots of problems can emerge in terms of systemic risks that affect the entire system. And that's why I focused on the housing system. The other issue with the housing system is it's a little bit easier to deal with the data in the APS 330 reports and do some clever things with the data, which I've tried to do here, than on the non-housing system. So for those two reasons, that was the source of me focusing on housing. So we've got a $2.2 trillion overall credit system. About $1.2 trillion of that is in housing. And we're at a point now where about 70% of that is being managed by the big banks through the advanced internal ratings-based approach to Basel II. And it is that advanced approach which has enabled me to do a lot of this analysis. There's still 32% of the system which is not being monitored under that approach, although that's going to narrow to about 20% once we get St. George and Bank West up in the next 12 months or so. St. George, I think, is next half. So that's going to make a bit more of a dent in that. And what it does for this style of analysis is it gives you the opportunity to have a reasonable sample size and maybe draw some conclusions around the overall system. A little bit about the majors. CBA and Westpac are the leaders in housing across Australia and New Zealand. NAB and ANZ are a little smaller. CBA and Westpac here, this is just their advanced balances. So on top of that, you've got St. George and Bank West. So They're the leaders by a long way in housing. And that becomes quite important when we start to look at some of the credit trends across those majors. Certainly if there's things going on within the credit books of CBA and Westpac, they have have quite a big impact on the overall system. And the other point here is that housing represents a considerable proportion of the big banks' overall lending portfolios. Again, the CBA and Westpac have a much higher weighting into housing. And I think it's, you know, we'll see that it has served them very well through the last couple of years to have such a high exposure to such a low-risk asset in housing. So I'll just go through a few key concepts which will be quite familiar to most here. But if you're not in banking, I'll go through these quite briefly. A little bit about the approach, so I hope some of you have read the paper. I won't go too much into the approach, but that's detailed within the paper. What I've done is taken data from the APS 330 reports, and I've developed a series of very simple relationships which model out some of these concepts which I'm going to go through now. And they calibrate these parameters back to the published numbers that are in the APS 330 report. So it's quite as simple as that. The relationships, I won't go through those in detail. They're in the paper and they're detailed in the paper. But the Basel II basis for home lending is quite prescriptive. If you go into APS 113, the formulas that are to be used for calculating capital are outlined and are followed by all the major banks. The bit that is the innovation from the Basel I basis is that the banks have the opportunity to use their own assumptions. And so that's given the ability for the public, which is guys like me who can sort of do this sort of stuff on the train going home. This is the opportunity is to actually, for the first time, compare an actual against an expected default rate for the major banks. And that, to me, was the real, this is something new. You know, we've always had actual default rates for the major banks even before Basel II came in. You can go back and look at the history of 90 days past due and gross impaired assets, which is a proxy for Basel II default. That's not new. So we can see the history of defaults and we can have discussions around where that might head. What is new is the ability to compare an actual against an expected. And in that ability to compare an actual against an expected, you can start to do the old-fashioned actuarial experience investigation, and I've got a couple of slides on that. So that's really, I suppose, the innovation which I've tried to bring through in this paper, the ability to do an experience investigation on the system and draw out some insights from that. So, but let's quickly go through a few concepts here. I won't spend too much on this. I've spoken about Basel II. So Basel II was the next step from Basel I. It's a more innovative way for the banks to measure their capital using their own internal assumptions. And if you sort of dig underneath the formulas which are prescribed by APRA, it does imply a long-tail distribution. And for the sorts of default rates experienced by the industry at the moment, it does imply that you need to hold capital for an event which might be around 13 times the sort of default rates which are currently being experienced. So it's quite, you know, that would be, that would sort of be up around 6-7% of your portfolio in impairment. And I think the last time I looked at RBA Financial Stability reports, the US is up around 6. So it would be quite a disaster for the Australian system, and the regulator is having the Australian system quite well capitalised against that sort of contingency. So a couple of concepts. We've got expected loss, which is the losses that we might expect to occur through the cycle. So I'll put in mode and mean. An important thing, if you look at the history of housing default rates, they've been quite low. But if you look at a long-term through-the-cycle mean and you're able to get enough history, And if you're if you started to build in these shocks, which you get from time to time over history, and certainly Australia has escaped such a shock, but we see it overseas, that the mean would be a little higher than the mode, so what you've observed. And that's the basis of the expected loss from the regulator point of view, a long-term through the cycle expectation of the default rates. And the unexpected loss is for those loans that are not in default. How many of those might we expect to go default in an extreme scenario and in the under the Basel II criteria, it's 99.9%. So I note that a AA rating, I think, is 99.97%, which would be even a little more onerous and certainly the basis for a lot of economic capital frameworks across the Australian banks. But the 99.9 gives you, as I said, about 13 times the PD that you're covered for. A little bit about default. So banking guys would know default roughly compares to 90 days past due. So anyone who hasn't paid their loan for the last 90 days, that loan will be flagged as being in default as far as Basel II is concerned, or alternatively impaired. So you can get situations where someone hasn't paid has paid their loan in the last 30 days, but it's pretty clear that they're not going to be able to pay their loan anytime soon. That's an impaired loan. That's the definition of default. A defaulted loan will not necessarily lead to a loss. It may be cured and going on. So it's quite a conservative measure of a loan that's of a problem loan. Default loss is another assumption which the banks make. That's an expectation of what sort of loss might be incurred if that loan forecloses. And the default loss, according to APRA, is something that needs to be considered in a quite a downturn situation. APRA also apply conservatism in the Australian environment by saying it has to be no less than 20%. Given that a lot of our loans start off with a loan-to-value ratio of 80%, I think the last numbers I looked at, the overall system, you guys might be able to hit, was around 50%. So in terms of the size of the loan compared to the value of the properties. So 20% is, again, quite a conservative assumption that's been made by APRA. And it's fair to say that the majority of loans that can't be repaid, you'd expect a lot of them to be able to be covered by the sale of the underlying property. Risk-weighted unexpected loss, I've covered that concept. Risk-weighted assets, I just thought I'd cover that because it's such a used term out there in the industry. It's a measure that's used to give you a sense of what the size of the unexpected loss is. And then the capital, which needs to be held to cover that unexpected loss, the rule of thumb is about 8% of that of those risk-weighted assets will be your capital requirement. Capital is a term you need to distinguish between the capital requirement, which is what APRA wants you to hold, versus your capital resource, which is what you actually have against that capital requirement. The current capital requirement is 8%. Which needs to be 4% at least in the really good tier one shareholders' equity style capital. That capital is absolutely well and truly covered. That requirement's well and truly covered by the banks at, I think, around 8 or 9% in terms of their tier one ratio at the moment. Leverage is a concept that you would have read in my paper. Leverage is of interest because the analysis I've done suggests that home lending has such a higher allowable leverage than non-home lending, although I also note in my paper that leverage at the group level for the banks has been reasonably well contained over the last couple of years, and I'll talk about a couple of reasons for that. And pro-cyclicality is another concept that I just wanted to cover in my paper. There was, as part of moving into the Basel II environment, there was a suspicion that a downturn credit environment might lead to a lot more capital needing to be held by the banks as credit quality deteriorated. And I've got some comments on that I'll make as well around what we've actually observed in 2009 and an outlook for the future. Are there any questions there before I move on around the approach? Okay. All right, at the very, very high level, these are really the outcomes that I got from the approach that I developed. For the overall system, if I split between the expected defaults over the long term and the actual defaults observed across the four major banks, the conclusion was there was a pleasing stability between September 08 and September 09 in terms of the expected defaults. The actual defaults crept up a little, which was to be expected given some of the stress that the housing credit system was under last year. And then in terms of leverage, which again is what I call regulatory leverage, so this is what the regulator would permit in terms of the debt to equity that needs to be used to fund lending balances, is up around the 50 mark. So that's come back a little bit, which you'd expect as credit quality deteriorates slightly. So that was, I found that quite insightful to do that analysis, just from the point of view of analysis of change, which I'll just flick to now. The analysis of change is something that my paper sort of outlines in terms of approach there, but it is designed to understand what is the drivers of change in capital from one period to the next. It's quite a simple approach that says that there's fundamentally three reasons that capital will change. One is volumes, second is a change to your expected assumptions, and third is a change to your actual assumptions. And the observation over 2009, to put these numbers into context a little bit, the capital requirement for housing has grown to about $17 billion. The overall capital requirement for the four major banks is over $100 billion. It's probably $100, $110 billion. So and the Tier 1 capital being held by the banks is around the same. So in terms of the capital requirement, the housing system is not a huge drain on the capital resources of the banks, but it does represent more than half of the total credit system, which is why I find this quite an intriguing little part of the Australian New Zealand credit system. So we did see over 2009 quite a strong growth in lending, home lending, and within the banks, so this is just advanced balances, advanced IRB balances, within the banks we also saw the major banks grab more market share. And so you actually had a situation where over $2 billion of capital requirement was added to the major banks over 2009 due to that growth in volumes. Although, as I've just shown in my previous slide, the actual PD stayed quite constant, maybe a very slight deterioration. The actual defaults deteriorated a little more noticeably. But the interesting thing about the relationships that have been developed in this paper is capital is a lot more sensitive to your expected default rate than it is to the actual default rate. And there's a couple of points that this brings out. The real source of any pro-cyclicality that you will see in the system is more the change in your expected assumptions and less so the change in your actual experience. And pro-cyclicality is something that would be contained to the extent that the industry can hold a reasonably constant expected assumption, notwithstanding that the actual experience might vary. If I just flick back to this chart, you'll see that the model outcomes on the left-hand side, it is almost indiscernible the step up in the PD. And the LGD has stayed quite constant by virtue of the fact that I think a lot of the majors are falling underneath this 20% floor. So it does give you a sense of how sensitive that capital requirement is. You can see there was about $500 million added to the system from that very indiscernible change in PD and LGD. And so what my paper did was just think a little bit more around, well, okay, we seem to have had a lot of stability in 2009 and that's good, and you would actually conclude that there wasn't a lot of evidence of pro-cyclicality in 2009. I think APRA takes some credit for that through their application of a 20% LGD. I just think Australia has benefited from a reasonably benign economic environment compared to some of the other places around the world. But it just sort of got me thinking around, is there anything inherent in this system where if we did get a deterioration in Australia, which we haven't really seen yet in the housing, if we did get a deterioration, would you see those PDs move in a more adverse way? Because that would be the PDs and the LGDs, that would be the source of pro-cyclicality. And given the size of the credit system within Australia, the Hamiltonian credit system, that could actually lead to some more meaningful capital impacts for the Australian banks. And I come up with four reasons why I think there is a tendency for pro-cyclicality within the Australian and New Zealand housing system. First of all, there were a lot of first home buyers that came through into the system. I think we had 35% of new home loans last year were to first home buyers. Generally, first home buyers are well able to repay their loans in the first few years, but once they push through the system, they can be the first cohort to feel real distress when things turn. And so that could be one reason why we might have a bit of an adverse pro-cyclicality impact if things got deteriorated in terms of the broader economy. I've also got a view that credit cycles will be redefined by the major banks. History is less useful now in terms of longer term credit cycles. Certainly the last 15 to 17 years, default rates in Australian banks have been very, very low. But the reality is I think we've learned in the States that history will say from time to time you'll get a large spike, so you'll get a tail event. And I think a lot of banks will maybe go back and review their PD models and just try to draw a new line which represents the long-term through the cycle PD rates, and that might lead to some capital impacts. Bank credit rating systems, I'll make some comments in the paper. I won't go into too much detail now, but I think there is a tendency that when you get broader deterioration in the credit environment, that PD, that the credit ratings on customers will slide. And so it will be very difficult for banks by virtue of the way that they assign credit ratings to customers, it'll be difficult for them to hold back PDs to be a nice stable through the cycle number in the event of a large deterioration in credit. And finally, the fact that loss given defaults have stayed so stable at around 20% over the last couple of halves. What's a little unclear, we don't have this transparency, is how close to that 20% level a lot of the major banks are. And as soon as the banks started popping through that level for whatever reason, it could be a large fall in domestic property prices, you could get some really quite significant capital impacts in terms of capital requirement for the banks. So that was my first insight, I suppose. It's been quite benign over the last 12 months, which has been very useful to the banks, helped them strengthen their capital ratios a lot. But I feel that there are some tendencies for future pro-cyclicality in the event of a deterioration. The second insight that I really wanted to draw out through my paper was just on home lending leverage. So home lending leverage can be calculated by simply assets divided by the capital requirement. And the biggest, it's just quite astounding how high leverage has risen as we've moved from B1 to B2 for home lending, so from 22 to 49. It has also risen for business lending, so there sometimes is comments made out there that sort of business lending has stayed flat in terms of its capital requirement. But Basel 2 has been friendlier to business lending as well. And these are exactly the reasons why APRA has decided to put in a Basel 1 floor, so there's a transition arrangement for the bank so that they don't let leverage get out of control as they move into Basel 2. And as I said, we've actually seen leverage at the group level come back, which is quite interesting. So the issue of leverage at the product level under Basel 2, it is just credit risk. So at the group, you've got all risks really that form part of that. And it is worth noting as well that Basel 1 was more than just credit risk. It was market risk and operational risk as well. But there is certainly quite a dramatic difference there. And my paper sort of goes on to talk about what the consequences of this leverage differential are. And certainly the differential is wider between home lending and business lending. I think all banks have benefited in terms of costs of capital by the move to Basel II for home lending. So my rule of thumb that I developed was cost of capital represents about 20 basis points of margin for home lending under a Basel II environment. It represents about 80 basis points for everything else. So it's quite a significant advantage there for home lending in terms of the cost of capital. And I go on to talk about retail banking more generally, that if the leverage is so high, are the banks getting a good return on their assets that gives them a really superior return on equity? My conclusion is yes. There's a lot of reasons to like home lending if you're a bank. You know, the risk is very, very low in terms of the loss rates. The ability to reprice outside the cycle to cover some of your costs like funding. There is just growing scale in housing. I think the system's grown by 13% per annum over the last 10 years. And just probably the thing that really really brings it home is a very, very profitable segment. Rivers of gold, it's often been called. One of the things that really brings it home is that when you start to sell business through your retail banking channel, so through your branch, often you can manage to get a credit card along with that. You can sell some insurance and get some commission revenue out of that. You can have other customers walking in who are giving you deposit income that's often at yields, although increasingly this is less the case, often at yields which are quite substantially below the cash rate. And it all just comes together to give you a fantastic business if you're an Australian bank that has been made even more more appealing under these very high leverage rates that are permissible. We then sort of go on to ask the question, well, let's just reflect for a moment. Just over the last 12 months, we've seen business lending really come back quite substantially in housing. This is system rates, and this is just Australia. We've seen housing hold together. Now, I do note that if I draw a line through through housing and business over the last 10 years, they're both around 13% per annum. So, you know, it's happened before, and this was outside the Basel environment. But I just sort of asked the question, well, is there any evidence that maybe the move to Basel II and the gap between the leverage permissible on home lending versus business lending, has that maybe influenced the business lending falling off the cliff? Now, I came to the conclusion that, well, I didn't come to any conclusion. I've said that there needs to be more research on this. And when I look at the demand and the supply side factors, there are a lot of demand side factors where businesses are just clearly deleveraging over the last 18 months as they get a little bit nervous about the state of the economy. And we've also got some stimulus by the government that's really propped up housing demand as well, where they're really actively trying to stoke the housing market and push first home buyers in through the first home buyers grant. So there are some demand factors which explain this trend. There's some supply factors as well around the constraint that we saw in funding last year. Probably for the first time, banks had to, think very, very carefully around how they allocated their very limited funding out in the form of loans. And certainly, irrespective of Basel II capital treatment, there was a lot of nervousness last year around how bad business and institutional losses could get if things really went belly up in the Australian economy. So I think banks, it is fact, the RBA confirmed this, that there was more upward repricing in business lending than home lending. And I think it was banks just wary of the risk. That said, I would be quite confident there are a lot of strategists within the big banks who were very, very comfortable for a lot of home lending to go out in the last 12 to 18 months. Even if things get a little worse in home lending, the loss rates are still just so low and the sector is so well collateralised that that there would have been a lot of push to really keep that home lending flowing. And there would have been that the added kicker of just the capital costs are just that bit lower under the Basel II environment as well. So So as I said, I didn't want to... I sat on the fence a little bit on this one, to be honest. I feel there needs to be more research before you can definitively say that the move to Basel II has caused any sort of distortion in the home lending versus business lending system growth rates. There would be others who would be a bit more confident to form a view one way or the other. But it is an important issue to do some more research on. The risk here is if funding becomes increasingly constrained and where the Australian banks start to lend out into non-productive housing, seeing people outbid each other for coastal property around the country, businesses start to be starved of capital and we don't get that reinvestment in our future growth. So it is an important issue, and I understand there's some... I think there's some government senate committees and stuff that are going to investigate some of these issues a bit further. If I just move on now for all the analysts in the room who like comparing peers, one of the things that this approach enables you to do is look at the four majors. And I found this quite fascinating. I've talked about the stability within the overall system, but you break it down across the four majors and you see some really interesting patterns in terms of the credit quality. I make a few observations within my paper, and certainly the purpose of this paper wasn't to form a view or an opinion on the relative performance of the four majors, but just to show what you can do with this data. Although I think the application of this type of diagnostic, certainly I've seen some of the stuff that the investment bank research analysts are doing with the APS 330 reports, and I think there's still a fair bit of evolution and innovation in the way they use that data going forward. I think off the back of this type of diagnostic, there could be some good questions that investment analysts might ask of the big banks. Certainly, if I just do a snapshot, NAB is quite clearly has the most risk in its home lending book, although it seems to be quite stable at the moment over the last 12 months. CBA is the fastest grower, but seems to be trading off risk for growth. They are increasing in terms of their actual default rates, but their long-term probability of default is also coming up as well, which is probably what you'd expect to see. But this is having quite a significant impact on CBA's capital requirement, given they're so overweight in home lending. ANZ, a little bit of a contradiction, and we see their actual default rates are deteriorating. However, their implied PD is stable, if not improving slightly. So obviously they either have a more favourable outlook on the credit quality, or alternatively they're just getting their models to settle in. And there is an element of this with these numbers. I think a lot of the banks are just sort of settling their models in, so that can sort of come through as noise. Interestingly, my earlier comment around it's actually favourable to see a nice PD through the cycle and just have your actual experience moving up and down through that stable PD, it may not be such a bad thing that ANZ's demonstrating that stability in its PD. Although, the real swinging thing that's going to move your PD is when you get a whole cohort of new business that comes in that is clearly of less quality, and that could be the case for CBA. They went very, very strong in first home buyers market, and maybe they're just seeing, as I said, they're trading off a little bit on the quality for growth. Interestingly, so did Westpac. You know, they went very strong on first home buyers through their RAMS channel, but when we look at these numbers, look, their actual defaults are bouncing around a little bit, but their expected default is stable, if not improving slightly. So I don't have the answers to why these trends are doing what they're doing, but I think the whole beauty of the APS 330 reporting is it actually provides transparency to the investment community and to the public to start to do some of this analysis and certainly go back and ask the banks some questions if things start to get out of control. Certainly from the point of view of managing systemic risk, if a large player like the CBA started to demonstrate an ongoing and consistent deterioration in their credit quality, it is in the national interest for an explanation to be given. And transparency is an amazing thing. You know, I'm a bit more less regulation, more transparency. And certainly if you look at Southwest Sydney, there were alarm bells around Southwest Sydney credit quality for the last 12 to 18 months. It was quite public in the press. and there were questions being asked around exposure to Southwest Sydney, you will now find that all the banks, one way or another, will give some sort of update on their exposure to Southwest Sydney and some of their implied arrear rates. So transparency sort of takes care of itself. If you provide transparency around where the hotspots are in the system, you'll find that the banks actually just step up to try to just calm any nerves with their investors to show that they're not either not exposed or that they're managing that exposure. So really, that is really one of the innovations, I think, out of APS 330, to provide the transparency to do a very simple actual versus expected comparison, which can highlight where there might be some issues within the system. I haven't mentioned this point, but I mentioned Australia and New Zealand. APS 330 bundles Australia and New Zealand at the moment into the one credit system. I don't really have a problem with that. I think a lot of the Australian banks, and I don't know, at risk of offending any Kiwis here, I think they largely manage their New Zealand exposures almost like another state. You know, certainly New Zealand wouldn't be as much bigger than the exposure that the big banks have in a New South Wales or a Victoria in terms of overall exposure. So I know there's some differences. But internationally, if you look at arrear rates, New Zealand and Australia track pretty closely. It's not like New Zealand's a Spain or a UK or the US. So this does merge this Australian-New Zealand experience together. I'll go on to some improvements, and granularity could be improved, but I didn't think that was stood in the way of this analysis too much. So moving on from peer comparisons, almost done now. The final thing that I did was I looked at what might be a plausible downturn scenario. Again, I reflect that the US is up around 5-6% in terms of their arrears. This was back in September. I haven't seen an update on that. It could be worse because it was certainly a vertical line that didn't look like settling down. UK and Spain are around 2-3%. And then we've got Australia around 0.6% and New Zealand. In terms of coming up with a plausible downturn scenario, and remember we're not completely out of the global economic issues yet, there were a lot of people saying Australia was heading right down the path of the US and broader Europe. Australia seems to have dodged that bullet. But it's just worth reflecting how bad could our default rates get if we entered a period where, for whatever reason, Australian economic activity started to slow down, interest rates went up, all those drivers of home lending default rates. My view is, it's the RBA's view, and I quote the RBA in my paper. The RBA's view is that Australia is different to the US. We have much tighter local credit settings. There's the consumer regulation is different. In the US, you can hand in your keys non-recourse. It's different in Australia. Our local interest rates have been higher in Australia. The home lenders have just got used to making repayments of much higher interest rate settings, and it would appear that the regulator was far more proactive than the US. So in terms of coming up with a default rate, I was reluctant to talk about the US scenario of 5%. I've come up with 2.5 times the current PD as an actual default rate. And consistent with my hypothesis that there would be an inclination for some pro-cyclicality to come through, I've got the PD moving from 0.6 to 0.9, which is 1.5 times. If you look at the actual distribution that's implied by the Basel II basis, I think that's about a 90% confidence interval. So these sorts of losses, we're sort of talking about a 90% confidence interval, 1 in 10-year scenario. And what these numbers show is I showed the 2009 numbers before. Numbers show that this sort of situation, I've ignored LGDs. Now, LGDs should be set on a downturn basis anyway, so you'd assume maybe 20% is about right if they've been set in the right way. One of my issues is I have absolutely no transparency around where the banks are sitting relative to that 20%. If they're sitting at 19 and 18, then you might start to say, well, OK, if we had a big fall in property prices, maybe they're going to poke through that and get to sort of 20, 22, 25, and that could have a big capital impact. But I don't have enough information to form a view on LGDs, so I've ignored it. But look, the conclusion to this is with this sort of scenario, which I'm calling a plausible 1 in 10-year downturn scenario, You're looking at about an extra $7 billion of capital required by the banks. As I mentioned before, Australian banks are only required to have 4% risk-weighted assets in their Tier 1 capital. It's up around 8 or 9%. Now, a lot of that is rating agencies want to see a nice high Tier 1 capital ratio. The Australian banks have a AA rating. They're one of the only banks to have such a high rating around the world. I don't think those Tier 1 ratios will be coming down anytime soon, but it does provide a very nice buffer to these sorts of downturn situations that could come through. Certainly, this sort of situation that I've modelled here for the four Australian banks is around 0.6% of risk-weighted assets. So it's well covered by their 8.8 to 9% Tier 1 ratios. But again, it's just this whole piece of analysis and paper that I've written is about the potential application of these relationships that I've developed. And I think the insights might come through just applying this as we move forward. So if we get a slip in the PDs, it's just useful to look at how much capital might be required if things start to turn adverse for the credit system, and then just compare that against the capital that is being held by the Australian bank. So I haven't seen that done before externally. So I just thought that was quite an interesting thing to do. The conclusion was that they are in very good shape, the Australian banks. Okay, so just to sum up before I open up for some questions, the APS 330 reports provide a very useful sample size to do this type of analysis. The system, to me, seems susceptible to pro-cyclicality, and so we just need to think about the implications of any downturn. Home lending leverage, to me, looks a bit high. A leverage of 50 just feels high, and I think there needs to be more work on, is that distorting the allocation of limited funding into the Australian banks between home lending and business lending, and what might be some of the long-term economic implications of that. The peer comparisons, I concluded there is variability across the four majors, and I think there's a whole host of reasons for that. There's competition strategy going on, but when you put all those together, it does seem quite stable. So from a system point of view, looks quite stable in terms of default rates and loss given defaults. The sector is very well capitalised for a downturn, and where to now? I conclude by actually saying I've done this analysis of four model points for each of the majors. If you found a way of getting the banks to pool all that data together, where you could actually do this sort of analysis and drill right into hotspots across the Australian system, either by geography or by customer type or by originator. And when you think about the root cause of the US system, it was really an origination problem. You just had a certain origination channel that was lending to people they shouldn't be lending to, and maybe that could have been stopped if you had pinpointed that segment and origination channel a little earlier in the American system. And so I'm actually just putting forward a view that if there could be some collaboration between regulators and the banks to somehow pool this data in the national interest, and get some sort of body somewhere. I noticed Tony Coleman yesterday mentioned the RBA has a financial stability group that is just looking at where's their fires going on across the Australian system that might lead to big systemic issues. I think there could be something quite powerful that could be developed here. And I liken the events in the US from a credit risk point of view as almost like the Asian tsunami, and what that's done for early warning mechanisms for tsunami research. I just think jurisdictions around the world should actually come together and try to build something similar to monitor systemic credit risks. And all the data's there, which is what I concluded when I went through this exercise. The data's there, just needs to be more granular. Yeah, I'll leave it there. I think I'm going to... Went a bit over time. Thank you.
That's a very informative session. Just open the floor. I think we've got about five minutes for discussions. If anyone's got any questions and comments, instructions I've been given is we need to talk through the mic. So, and if you could just introduce yourself.
Sure. So, Jazz, MLC NAB. I was just wondering if, as the industry and public develop more understanding and awareness of default rates, would it ever lead to more kind of differentiated general insurance style pricing of mortgages, as in which allows for different default rates for, say, Southwest versus Northwest? Because at the moment it's very kind of generic. Yeah. Either you have a low doc loan, you have X percent, or your normal customer, Y percent. So I've always wondered, why isn't there more differentiation between good and bad clients?
Yeah, do you have a comment on that, James? Mm.
Could we just highlight that the credit losses are extremely small for mortgages, so the differential by geography is not particularly material. Maybe there's some hotspots like Western Sydney that might be appropriate to charge a bit more for, but it's harder in a commodity market to charge more than the advertised price. Customers tend to shop around the advertised price, and it's easy to discount the advertised price, but it's not charging to a lot.
Yeah, thanks. To charge more than the advertised price. But probably the main factor is because the expected losses are so low, it's hasn't been a big driver of pricing differential, but recognise that there are capital implications.
I'd imagine if returns on assets for home lending started to come back a little bit more through competition or whatever, people might start sharpening the pencil on passing through the capital, the true risk, cost of risk through capital. At the moment, the returns have just been so good that the industry has been able to afford more generic pricing.
So I was going to ask about, with the transition from Basel 1 to Basel 2, I guess risk weighted on home loans dropped from 50% to around 20%, which I think you pretty much answered on the way through. Also, at the moment, we have the LGD floor of 20% for home loans, which I guess there's some expectation that won't be around forever. Would you expect many changes from banks if that LGD floor were to be removed?
One of the points of improvement. So first thing, I actually give my support to the whole Basel II framework for banks. It's been a significant investment, and I think this sort of transparency is a real benefit of that investment. Despite the fact there's been some fairly public questions around the validity of Basel II and sometimes ill-found comments. Although I do say that one of the things that could be improved is the lack of transparency around the LGD. So I really haven't had a lot to say around the LGD floor in the paper because I just have no visibility around where bank calculated LGDs are relative to the APRA floor. Clearly, they're below it in most cases because all the banks are disclosing 20%. Yeah, I really don't have a sense for how close they are to that 20%. I notice in the UK they use a 10% LGD floor, and my sense is they're still below that. Do you have a sense on that?
So the 10% is just the one in the accord. So APRA's taken the 20% view that they think the market's, potentially got overvaluation in.
Yeah.
So. And that's a real risk, and so it's actually a really good thing to have in there at present, I think.
Yeah, it really mutes the pro-cyclicality, but I don't have a sense for how low those LGD floors are, because if you remove the LGD floor and you had a 5% LGD, the reduction in capital would be quite substantial for the Australian banks. Yeah.
So on that point, there are a lot of model calibrations that have to be done to understand that, so it's an interesting question. A lot of the banks believe they're sort of near the 20% floor, but as experience is coming through, they're trying to work that piece out. Mm. So it's still not as clear. And the lack of transparency, people have ignored it because it's 20%.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how transparency focuses efforts, and internally we are focusing efforts on things because of this data now, which is good.
Yep.
Just on that, don't really need this, but just on that issue of transparency, does lender's mortgage insurance potentially reduce that transparency even more? I mean, is that, even if you did bring the rates down, would you be able to see who actually had these exposures if there's a lot of cross transfers with Genworth and the banks?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it's a good point, but possibly not. Now, I think this is before the risk has been transferred through lender's mortgage insurance, all these numbers here. So that's an issue for the banks, and certainly securitisation can be an issue as well, although that market's dried up somewhat. I don't think securitisation was used anywhere near as much as what's used in the States, for example. But that's a good point. Securitisation and lender's mortgage insurance might make it a little more difficult. But then again, if you had all the LMIs and banks just sharing data, you could maybe sort of piece all that together and track it.
Through the APS 330, it's a very, very thick document, so to decompose it the way that Tim has done it.
Oh, thanks.
Very, very.
Cheers. Yeah, thanks for coming, guys. Appreciate that. Yeah.